these papers, and I want to particularly acknowledge my collaborators who are here at Perimeter. So we've heard very exciting different proposals for addressing this problem. And to me, what makes me hopeful that we'll eventually crack the problem of the cosmological constant.
I should turn this on.
I should know better, yeah. So, yeah, what makes me hopeful is that hopefully we'll get guidance from observation, from cosmological observations. So cosmology is now a mature field, and we now have a standard model, which is the Lambda CDM model. And what's great about this model, in my opinion, is that it's remarkably predictive. So essentially, with one parameter, lambda, you uniquely predict the expansion history of the background, as well as the evolution, more importantly, the evolution of perturbation in this background. So it's an easily falsifiable model, I would say, because of this tight connection. And what gives me hope is if you look back a few years ago, so I realize we're a room full of experts, but I think it's useful to take a step back and just, you know, tap ourselves on the back. Well, not me, but whoever takes these observations. So the field in general, that this was the situation just 10 years ago, okay? And the graph is faint because the situation was pretty faint. That, you know, you had the COBE data on large scales, on large angular scales. And for the first time, just about 10 years ago to the date, one experiment, the TOCO experiment, had measured the rise and fall of the first acoustic peak of the microwave background. Oh, from the original TOCO paper. TOCO was an experiment with Amber Miller and the Princeton group in Chile. Yeah, this was a very important result because it showed the universe was flat and gave evidence for inflation. And this is the situation today, less than 10 years later. Okay. So it's just amazing, even though we've all seen this before, just how much in less than 10 years the error bars have shrunk. And just by eye, we went from one peak to basically 6 peaks, just by eye. Polarization of the microwave background was only detected 7 years ago by the DAISY experiment. And 7 years later, we now have a beautiful TE cross-correlation measurement, as well as the autocorrelation of the polarization with itself. You can actually see by eye again the acoustic oscillations in the spectrum. So it's just amazing how fast this field is moving. And so that gives me hope that, you know, about the future. And indeed, there's no end in sight. Okay, there's just a whole bunch of experiments coming up, including Planck, which was launched 2 weeks ago. There's some CMB experiments going on. Large-scale structure experiments, like dark energy survey, LSST in the future, and futuristic experiments like 21 centimeter. So the future is bright. There's going to be more data coming in. And so indeed, you can ask at this juncture, you know, whether we've reached the end. As Jim Peebles said, whether Lambda CDM is the end of the line, the completion of all the fundamental physics we need to fit all of the cosmological data ever in the future, or whether Lambda CDM is the simplest approximation we're able to get away with at this point. Okay. Or if you want to put it more bluntly, will the convergence to Lambda CDM continue, or are we in for a big surprise? So as Cliff nicely summarized yesterday, the CC problem is a much more severe hierarchy problem than, say, the weak hierarchy problem because of the powerful no-go theorem by Steven Weinberg, which says that basically dynamical relaxation mechanism in which some scalar or collection of scalars relax dynamically as the CC is changed is not possible if you have a massless spin two graviton, if the media of gravity is this massless spin two particle.
Okay.
So you cannot just solve it by a small tweak to the theory. Something more radical is required. So in my opinion, there's sort of two broad strategies that one can employ. I sort of view it as two separate branches. So one would be to modify the theory somehow in the UV by having new physics at a submillimeter scale, which will somehow modify your expected radiative corrections to lambda. And this is sort of what, this is indeed in the class of theories that Cliff was describing in Susha yesterday in the SLED theories. Or the alternative is to actually modify gravity at large distances. That, in fact, what you assume about GR is breaking down at cosmological distances. And here, the basic idea is very simple, that the vacuum energy is actually large, like you would expect from quantum field theory. But in fact, it just gravitates very weakly. So the equivalence principle here is violently broken. We're making a distinction between vacuum energy and localized sources. And just at lambda, you just don't see it gravitationally very much. And this is the broad idea of the gravitation. So phenomenologically, how would you capture this kind of behavior? So the basic idea is that gravity, Einstein's equation, is turned into a high-pass filter form of this. So you're promoting G Newton into a function of the derivative operator in this way, so that G Newton becomes a high-pass filter. So localized sources, or sources of high frequency, like the sun, gravitate normally because G Newton tends to constant. But long wavelength sources, like lambda, actually gravitate very weakly. G Newton goes to zero. They degravitate. So just to, since this equation may appear ad hoc at first sight, just to bring down to Earth with a simple concrete example that with more familiar physics is in the context of VNM, okay? So suppose you ask, let's consider the closest analog to the CC problem in the context of electromagnetism. So the closest analog you can think of for a constant energy density source would be to look at a uniform charge density in ENM. This is a classical analog. And with this kind of source, you know, of course, that the solution will have the electric field growing linearly unbounded. And this is the analog of the unbounded growth of the Sitter space. And indeed, you can make this precise if you choose a particular gauge for the Coulomb potential. You find that the Coulomb potential grows as T squared, which is precisely the analog of the growth of, in the equivalent gauge in gravity, that the metric perturbation grows also as T squared. Okay, so there's an exact parallel between the two problems. Okay, so if you wanted to solve this unbounded growth, to solve this problem, there are two possible strategies you could follow. One would be to turn on a mass for the photon. This will clearly shut down this infrared growth of the electric field. Or, analogous to what I discussed before, you could turn Maxwell's equation into a high-pass filter equation by making the susceptibility a function of the derivative operator. So I want to argue that, in fact, these two strategies in ENM are precisely equivalent. Okay, and it's a very short proof. So to show this, let's start with the general theory of a massive photon, which is Broca theory. This is the equation here. And of course, as you know, although this doesn't look gauge invariant, you can always make it manifestly gauge invariant by introducing a Stueckelberg field. So you write the vector potential as a sum of the usual Maxwellian vector potential. This guy shifts in the usual way under gauge transformation, plus a longitudinal component, which shifts accordingly to make this guy fully gauge invariant. Okay, so in this theory, the gauge field itself is a physical observable. It's a gauge invariant object. Now the trick is if you substitute this expansion, this decomposition, into the profile equation, you use the Bianchi entity and you massage this a little bit, you can solve for the Goldstone field and get an effective equation purely for the Maxwell field. And after these two steps of gymnastics, what you end up with is this equation for the Maxwell field. So this is an effective equation of the Maxwell field once you've integrated out the Goldstone from the equation for motion. And it's precisely of the filter equation we were describing. This operator out front precisely looked like a momentum-dependent susceptibility operator, which basically makes the source de-electrified, I guess you would say. Okay, so in this very simple way, you see that adding a mass is precisely the same as making the theory into a high-pass filter. Is that right, for filtering? Interesting. Pardon me? It's local, absolutely. This is the point. So this didn't look local whatsoever, but now I've shown you there's a perfectly fine local theory that is exactly equivalent to it. It doesn't look local because you've integrated out a massive degree of freedom. And it's clear that this theory at least solves our analog problem of the CC, because if you now take the equation and turn on a uniform charge density source, then there's now a very nice solution in which the gauge field is just constant. So the electric field is precisely zero. And this is a well-known phenomenon. Of course, the theory of spontaneously broken U1 is a superconductor. And so what we're observing here is just that in a superconducting state, charges are screened, and so there is screening of this uniform charge density. And so this is basically the proposal that the degravitation of lambda is the analogous phenomenon to this screening of the uniform charge density in a superconducting state. So we're looking at Higgs phases of gravity in this context. Okay, so we can do the same with gravity. As was described yesterday, the most general theory, which is Goltz-free and tachyon-free, of a massive graviton is the Peierts-Pauli theory. And all I've done here is to generalize the mass term to make it a function of the derivative operator. And we'll say, in a few minutes, we'll say more generally what this function is allowed to be. But for now, just think of it as a general mass term. So we can play the same game as before. You can introduce Stueckelberg fields for the four broken diffs here. You can integrate them out by using the Bianchi identity. And at the end of the day, indeed, you can recast this equation into a filter equation for the helicity 2 part, the Einsteinian part of the metric when it's all said and done. Okay, so this is the conclusion that the pretty powerful statement is that any theory that tries to filter out the CC, quite generally, anything you write down, has to be equivalent at the linearized level to a theory of massive or resonance gravity. Of course, the converse is not true, but this direction is absolutely true. And the immediate implication, as soon as you do this, so what you learn is that any theory of filtering immediately says that there has to be new degrees of freedom for the graviton. You don't just have the usual two helicity two, but you have, of course, as usual, the five polarization of the graviton. And in particular, observationally, in fact, as Lama and Gazal will tell us this afternoon, this is the guy where all the fun is taking place. Okay, this is the culprit for all the fun phenomenology. By the way, you should feel free to stop. Yes, thanks, John.
I can always count on you too.
I always like to show consistency. Whenever you see helicity zero, you start worrying about stability.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's right. So here there's some, so in massive gravity, as was discussed yesterday, this guy actually, this guy, in fact, is problematic in massive gravity. But in the theories we'll describe later, it's actually much better. Okay, so all the equations are second order.
One other comment.
Yes.
Max and Crocker, you don't have this problem because the zero is not.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So here, this guy couples to the source even as n goes to zero. So that there's excess out of these. Absolutely. Okay. So the allowed class of modifications. So what are the allowed functions for the mass that we're gonna consider? So of course there are general functions allowed, but for simplicity, we're gonna consider a rather simple parameterization. So we're going to take this mass term to be just a power law of the momentum with the power alpha. And there are various, and indeed this is a useful parameterization because all the classes of theories we'll look at later, they all reduce to this form at least at long wavelengths. So it's a useful toy parameterization to keep in mind. Now, in order for this to be a modification valid in the infrared, relevant in the infrared, clearly this has to be this has to go to zero less fast than p squared, than the actual wave operator, for this to dominate in the infrared. So alpha has to be less than one. Otherwise, it just becomes irrelevant. And secondly, the corresponding propagator to this mass, if you wanted to have a well-defined spectral representation, a positive definite spectral representation, alpha has to be greater than zero. Okay, so there's a use to this. It's a one-line proof, so let me just give it to you. If you write down the spectral representation for this object, so by assumption, we're assuming there is a well-defined spectral representation. like this. And if m is of the form p to the 2 alpha, with alpha negative, if alpha were negative, let's assume it's negative, then this guy, as p goes to 0, will just go to 0. But clearly, you cannot have that. His rho is positive definite. Okay. So alpha has to be greater than or equal to 0 to have a well-defined spectral representation. And then there's a technical requirement that in some particular limit of the theory, namely the decoupling limit, if this degravitation phenomenon is valid at the linearized level, alpha has to be strictly less than a half. Okay, so that's a more technical point. But in any case, the valid range at the end of the day is that zero. Mm-hmm. Alpha has to range between 0 and a half. Yes?
Is this local?
Yeah, it's local. So it's a sum over massive states. That's what this theory is going to
do. I don't know if you need to master the swim one that you showed before. It doesn't work exactly here, right? And there you start from the Proker equation that
right. Is
constant and
right.
converts into one. And here you start from an equation in which m squared already contains the
derivatives. That's right. But it's local in this sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's local in this sense. Okay. Just to give you two cases, of course, pure massive gravity is alpha is 0, and the DGP model, which we'll discuss, is alpha is a half. We'll see, in fact, that alpha is 0 actually describes all the higher codimension generalizations of the DGP model. So it's interesting, the two endpoints of this interval are actually physically quite relevant. Okay, so this is the executive summary so far, that what we've shown is that any theory that sort of hopes to be sort of some kind of filter theory or degravitation theory has to reduce to a massive or resonance theory. And moreover, in general, indeed, if it's a resonance, then it's a sum over a spectral density. And so the graviton is made out of massive graviton states of that arbitrarily small mass. Okay, so there's no KK gap in this theory. And so in particular, you're led to, this immediately points to the idea of infinite volume in certain dimensions. Infinite volume says there is no KK gap. Or as Gia would like to say, that if it walks like extra dimensions and talks like extra dimensions, it's probably extra dimensions. And so you're left to the idea, so once you make this realization that somehow extra dimensions are involved, then you're left to the idea that perhaps this filtering idea of gravity is nothing but some effective description of the old idea of Rubokov and Shapovalikov. That basically you have a brain in some extra dimension, and the vacuum energy on the brain curves the bulk, but not the induced geometry on the brain. So it's pretty nice how these different ideas sort of fit together in one framework. So I'm going to skip this. Just to advertise that this idea has
actually important observational consequences. That Ghazal will discuss this afternoon. And in particular, there are some anomalies in the data that these modifications can improve upon and actually explain possibly. So this will be definitely these sort of ideas will be tested. Okay, let's move on to explicit constructions. So of course the first thing, the best known example in this class of theory is the model of Valli-Gabadadze-Porati, in which the visible degrees of freedom are confined to a four-dimensional one brain with one extra dimension extending to infinity. And the point, of course, is that there are two Planck scales in this problem, a bulk Planck mass and a brain Planck mass. And so there's a characteristic Planck scale that you can construct, which is this RC scale given by the ratios of them. And what this says is that in this model, gravity, because of the presence of this induced gravity term, gravity at short distances here is going to behave as 1 over r squared. But once you go to sufficiently large distances, the gravitational flux lines, they escape in the bulk, so to speak, and force weakens to 1 over r cubed. And this already is an indication of this degravitation phenomenon, in some sense, that you have a weakening of the force law as you go to very large distances. Okay, this manifestly violates the equivalence principle. And indeed, if you look at the linearized equation of motion for metric perturbations on the brain, It precisely has the form of what we were describing earlier. It's a Pierce-Pauli mass term, where the mass has a power for the box operator, which corresponds to alpha is a half. So it's exactly of the form of what we want, which is encouraging. Except when you go to the nonlinear level, you can derive in this model an exact Friedman equation on the brain. And this is what it looks like. So at the nonlinear level, this looks like a failure of the degravitation idea, in the sense that if I put a large cosmological term, it is going to yield a very large expansion rate. But already, nevertheless, you can see some glimmer of degravitation, in the sense that the correction term that you get, which goes as h over rc, comes with a minus sign. So for a given lambda, the expansion rate is reduced a little bit. Okay, so it's moving in the right direction. Now, why it didn't work, of course, is that, one way, there are many ways to see it, but one way is that perhaps this weakening of gravity wasn't steep enough. You only went from 1 over r squared to 1 over r cubed. And so the immediate thing to do is to look for higher codimension models where now the weakening will be from 1 over r squared to 1 over r to some higher power. Or in terms of alpha, if you like, completely equivalent perspective, is that this model with alpha is a half, whereas I had argued earlier that you needed alpha strictly less than a half. So it's kind of like the borderline case, which is why degravitation kind of shows its tail, but is not really there. Whereas, as I mentioned earlier, all these higher codimension models, they all correspond to alpha is approximately zero. Okay, so this is the way to go. So I'm glad that Alberto gave this nice presentation of higher codimension models. So some of it we've seen already. Let's suppose you brute force try codimension 2 DGP. Okay, so you consider a brain, a three brain, in a six-dimensional bulk, again with their respective Planck scales. So here the story gets technically much more difficult, okay, for a couple of reasons. One, as was discussed already, that in this case the brain-to-brain propagator is logarithmically divergent. There's some divergence when you ask about the force between two points on the brain. The Green's function diverges logarithmically, which so you have to cut it off with some brain thickness or some regularization mechanism. So this is just a technical hurdle. It's not a showstopper. But more importantly, the more dramatic feature is that there are ghost fluctuations even around flat space. Okay, so the theory seems perturbatively unstable at phase value, as was pointed out by these authors. And so for many years, there was a debate as to whether higher codimension DGP was consistent or whether it didn't make any sense whatsoever. So this is the work that we've done, and similar work by Nemanja and his student. So the idea of this cascading gravity is to embed this codimension 2 brain on which we live on a codimension 1 brain itself living in a six-dimensional ball. Okay, this holds in any codimension, but the simplest example is for the codimension 2. So here you have three Planck scales, so you can construct two crossover scales. And so the force law will go from 1 over r squared at short distances to 1 over r cubed to 1 over r to the fourth as you probe larger and larger distances. That's why we call it cascading gravity. This cascade through successive regimes of the force law. Now, this looks a bit ad hoc, but it has the reason we're excited about it is it has a host of interesting properties. So in particular, the first thing it does, as soon as you put your brain onto a parent brain, it makes this divergence of the propagator, it regularizes it. So you don't need to thicken the brain. And there's an easy argument as to why that's the case. So remember, okay, so let's think of DGP on this codimension 1 brain. You know that at short distances, gravity, basically at short distances, you recover the usual force law on that brain. And so the ball completely decoupled. So at short distances, as you approach this codimension 2 brain, you just have 5D gravity. So what used to be a divergence having to do with this guy being embedded in six dimensions goes away, because now it looks like as if it's embedded in five dimensions. So indeed, the Green's function reduces to the usual codimension 1 Green's function as you approach. Okay. So just the fact that there is this codimension 1 brain regularizes the framework. And indeed, if you work out the Green's function, you find that it behaves again as a logarithm of the momentum, but now regularized explicitly by this crossover scale involving the 5D and 6D, 6D Planck scale. Yeah. And more importantly, if you add a small tension, on this guy, you find that the resulting spectrum is ghost-free. Okay, you've cured this ghost instabilities I discussed earlier. Okay, so this seems to be, at least at face value, a consistent framework to study. So first of all, it's a new class of modified gravity theories, and it sort of offers a nice framework to realize this idea of filtering, this idea of degravitation. And of course, it's completely generalizable to arbitrary co-dimensions. You can just keep on putting grains on higher and higher dimensions into one another. Okay, so does it actually work in degravitating vacuum energy? So this is the key question, of course. Okay, so let's start with codimension two story. So we consider a codimension two brain on this codimension one. Once you add tension on this guy, what happens is that it basically folds the codimension one into some wedge geometry in this way. Okay? And this sort of deficit angle, so to speak, or the angle of the wedge, is as usual related to the tension that you put on the codimension two. Now, the nice feature of this solution is that, first of all, it's non-singular everywhere, except for the usual delta function singularity here. But that's not really a singularity. Strictly speaking, the bulk geometry is completely flat. And moreover, the induced geometry on this brain is exactly flat. Okay, even though there's tension, you have a flat induced geometry. There's a one parameter family of solutions. As you change the tension, there is, of course, the bulk just readjusts itself. This parameter beta is related to the brain tension, just adjusts itself to keep the induced geometry flat. Note that it's crucial that the extra dimensions have infinite volume. Okay? As was discussed yesterday by Cliff, as soon as you compactify the extra dimensions, this tension has to be canceled by some kind of, by Gauss's law. Once you compactify the extra dimension, will have to be canceled either by fluxes in the bulk or by some tension of some other brain. So it's crucial here the extra dimension is infinite, so that in fact there is nothing to, you don't need to cancel this against anything. Like it just simply, all that it does is create this wedge geometry. Okay, so these are the pluses. Yes.
I think the curvature actually cancels the tensions.
Well, then there's a question of, right, so then there's a question of that adjustment, you know, whether you relax to it dynamically.
Right.
You know, here, because there is no cancellation, I would say the sort of relaxation is trivial.
Well, here is still the same question, that if you said that there's a consistent flat solution in the brain, but that's
right.
Not the only solution. There could be other solutions.
Yeah, so okay, so you have to show that indeed, if I give it a tension and I start from some arbitrary state, what does it relax to? So I'll admit that we haven't studied that.
Well, have anyone ever showed that there are, you know, consistent self-adjusting solutions?
Well, the problem is, no, this is a great question, right? No, absolutely. But the problem is that the advantage of DGP was that you could get a Freeman equation purely from the Israel junction condition. You got a local Freeman equation on the brain. Here, there's far less symmetry. It's a whole mess to derive a Freeman equation. Claudio and Andrew have worked out in some limit what the Freeman equation looks like. But in general, it's very hard.
But to get this real transition of different inverse powers over R, You, if I remember correctly, you need to be in the near critical limit with the.
Oh, with the tension.
Yes, right.
You say to avoid the ghost, or
to avoid the ghost, and to have the hierarchically different scales over which gravity looks 4 or 5 or 6 and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, no, there's some gravity. I don't remember, but there's some parametric.
So is that right? I remember that in fact. Okay, so you have to have basically a very narrow formal, right?
It doesn't have to be streaming. There's still some range.
Yeah. Well, I know, but in some models, well, anyway. I mean, the point is that the question that you have to worry about is that, you know, it's the radiative corrections to that tension of the brain. you see, because that may actually, anyway, don't talk about that. It may just mess things up in terms of randomness.
That's a good point, right?
So because you find solutions that do, in principle, realize exactly what you're saying.
Right.
But the moment you do one loop, they won't. Unless you're doing something.
No, but absolutely. So this is the point here.
All right.
No, in fact, you can show, well, of course, so this wedge is related to the usual deficit angle.
Right.
So so one disadvantage of this is that this guy has to be less, of course, than M6 to the fourth. And this M6 has to be less than, the millimeter inverse.
Right.
So usual tangent even the fourth screws itself. Now this is the point, of course. Okay. So these are
strikes again.
Hmm?
The landscape strikes again.
Well, I don't know. I didn't mention the L word or A word.
Well, if you have a lot of different brains and a lot of different intersections, a lot of different possibilities, it's there. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to be completely agnostic about things like this. Okay. So these are the disadvantages. On the one hand, this one, and the second one, which is a criticism that is often raised, is that, well, is this really the gravitation, or is this just the usual mechanism of a cosmic spring, which is just curving the extra space, but remaining its geometry flat? Okay, so these are the two questions. Now, we think, and we have good reasons to believe, that this is an artifact of the input dimension. Okay, that this is a geometrical condition that is intrinsic to codimension 2, but in higher codimension, as was mentioned in the previous talk, that this restriction will likely go away. And similarly, the other motivation for going to higher codimension is that you'll see whether it's really a cosmic string, is specific to cosmic string, or whether it's more general. Okay, so just briefly, I'll tell you what was the story with higher codimension. In a different context of what was described in the previous talk. So people have looked at codimension n greater than 3. Okay, let's take n to be 3. And they've looked at a pure DGP story. So you have you're on this codimension n brain with your DGP term, and you live in this higher dimensional ball. And people have looked for static solutions where the induced geometry is flat on the brain, and then the functions are purely functions of the radial direction away from the brain. And it's a bit messy. What you find is that your coefficient are some function, some powers of f, where f is a function that blows up as r goes to 0. Okay, so there's a naked singularity in this geometry, which is not so surprising. You could have said, okay, I put a brain here, put a higher dimension brain, probably it's going to generate a naked singularity. But the real issue is that it's a really funny naked singularity. Okay, on the one hand, the size of the brain, said by A, that the size of the dimensions parallel to the brain, is actually shrinking to 0 as you approach the origin. And moreover, it's not really an origin in any sense of the word. Because you can see that the higher dimensional sphere is actually blowing up in size as you approach r goes to 0. So really, you're completely delocalizing the brain in this limit. Okay, so it's a very funny singularity. Now, what these guys argued, which is a very interesting statement, is that this singularity might be an artifact of assuming by hand that this is actually exactly Minkowski. And if you allow the brain to be inflating, if you allow it to be the sitter, then they have arguments that this will generate a horizon to shield this singularity. And they argued more interestingly that this Hubble, the Hubble rate on the brain for a large codimension, for codimension greater than 3, becomes inversely proportional to the tension on the brain. That's their argument. Basically, because the Hubble rate is related to the size of the Schwarzschild radius in the extra dimension. Okay, so we take a different approach. Let's look again at this cascading.
What would be the physical scale of that Hubble? So this is M4 plus M.
Yeah, this is the higher dimensional Planck scale. So it's a tiny scale in these models because the crossover scale. Well, let's see.
Could it be that?
Well, it's a usual thing. So if it's codimension 2, that's a millimeter. If it's codimension 3, it's less than a millimeter. Because you want to constrain the crossover scale as to be of order Hubble, something like that.
So this can be today's Hubble scale, right?
This is the point. So the point is that this lambda is humongous. For humongous lambda, you can take Hubble. But, yeah. Okay. Now, this was a story in the usual for dimension 3. In the cascading, we have a different story in the cascading picture. So let's do this codimension 3 example. So here's our brain living on the codimension 2 brain, which itself is on the codimension 1 brain in a 7-dimensional ball. And so here, so now, of course, in this case, the bulk solution will now depend on 3 coordinates. So it's basically impossible to find analytic solutions for the exact ball geometry. But what we can do as a first step is to study the weak field limit. So we assume the tension is small, and we just want to see as a proof of concept, can we get a flat solution on the brain? So it's actually pretty nice. You can show using gauge freedom that you can put the 7D metric in this simple form. So you can write it all in terms of a single function phi, which depends on these 3 coordinates, some kind of Newtonian potential. And if you solve these equations, the equations of motion, well, they take the usual cascading form. Okay. And this is the explicit solution when you put a tension lambda on this codimension 3 object. Okay, so this is a god-awful looking solution, but it has a host of nice properties. So in particular, it's completely finite. Okay. So it doesn't blow up anywhere on the brain or away from the brain, precisely because of this cascading regularization mechanism. Okay, so it remains finite and perturbative everywhere, so the weak field approximation is under control. And moreover, the induced geometry is indeed flat on the brain. Okay, so at least at the weak field level, codimension 3 degradation seems to be realized. Now, of course, you would like to go beyond weak field and study large brain tensions, that's the whole point. But again, because of this lack of symmetry, this will require numerical analysis, and right now we're discussing with Tom Gitman how to proceed with this. But to me, it's an encouraging first step. Okay, so to conclude, to address the CC problem, you have to give up something. And here what we've given up is that 4D general relativity is not recovered in the infrared. And we've seen the sort of nice logical steps that if you try to filterize or degravitate CC, you're led to theories of passive or resonance graviton, which leads you to extra dimensions. It doesn't mean that extra dimensions are required, but this is sort of the nice arena where to realize these ideas. Cascading gravity offers an explicit setup to study this concept. And as Ghazal is going to talk this afternoon, it has testable observational consequences. So thank you very much.
Okay, the mode which created instability.
The sixth mode. Yeah. Right.
What is the spin and do you remember which mode it is? And how is it eliminated when you put brains inside each other?
Yeah, so in VGP, the sixth mode. So I only know the story really in standard VGP, okay? The higher co-dimension is more subtle. But in massive gravity, if you focus on the phi mode, you get some horrific, you get some interactions of this form suppressed by some cutoff, some power. And the point is, it's manifestly higher order. So when you work out the equation of motion, so although this is an interaction term, the equations of motion are higher order. And so indeed, if you perturb around some non-trivial background, there is a ghost perturbation associated with these higher-order equations of motion. So this is massive gravity. Here's following. Now in UGP, and this is the sixth mode, of course. This extra mode is a sixth mode that resurrects. In UGP, there's some miracle that the leading interaction term is instead of this form. Okay, so that although it looks higher derivative, when you work out the equations of motion, it's actually there's some miracle which makes the equation second order. Okay, so DGP, the sixth mode doesn't reappear on it.
It's a symmetry. It's the fact that you
absolutely this is absolutely
by
absolutely
thingy.
So the reason that
you shift it by a vector and this
absolutely no absolutely so the symmetry is this guy. There's a shift symmetry that shifts d mu phi. Which constrains hiding these interactions, and this is the leading one.
I'm not sure if you're answering my question.
Oh, okay.
You said that when you go to four dimension two brain, in the original paper of Duvalier and Shipman and Lebesgue,
right.
then the situation that the solution is unstable.
Right. Right.
Is this unstability here?
The instability, no, it's a different one, I think.
Yeah, that's the one I'm
okay, so sorry, you were talking about that instability.
Yeah,
yeah, so the instability is a bit subtle, as Cody mentioned, too, in their analysis.
So, but that one was all the fixed mode, it wasn't, the that one was
no, no, exactly. Zero. Zero. So it's a mixing between the helicity and the helicity. So, so the point is that when you turn on this 40 DGP term, the conformal mode for the 40 metric, which is normally a gauge degree of freedom, here mixes with the fifth mode. And when you diagonalize the kinetic matrix, you find that one of the mode is actually ghost.
And when you make it cascading?
Yeah, so now the key is that you add now a tension on the codimension two, okay? And that combined with the fact that you have a mass, an applied mass in the codimension one, you can show that this generates an extra contribution to the kinetic matrix. So that they have, so the kinetic matrix has positive eigenvalues. Yes.
Oh, sorry, John, yeah, right. What about the equivalence principle? Because you, if you, as I said yesterday, if you start suppressing the coupling,
right,
after polarization,
right,
you immediately get into trouble.
Yeah, so this is very long way by. Yeah, this is so the equivalence principle violations themselves are visible at the Hubble distances. So this scale RC, which is tiny. The more testable sort of the predictions for local tests, which one can go after, is that there are small corrections to the Newtonian potential. So when you can look at the orbit of the moon around the Earth, which is highly constrained by lunar laser ranging, so DGP itself is at the borderline of being ruled out by these measurements. And the higher codimension ones are far less. The constraints are much less stringent for those tests.
4D, if you want to suppress the vacuum density to 10 to the minus 3 electron volts.
Yeah, right.
And you immediately kill the vacuum polarization on the hydrogen atom.
Yeah, the point is that, the vacuum energy is whatever it is supposed to be, but what we're suppressing is its coupling to gravity. So although vacuum energy, we think of it as some local, some UV physics generating it, as far as how it couples to gravity, it's the longest wavelength, because the k equals zero mode. So we're shutting off the k equals zero mode of the stress tensor.
Do you not worry about micron distance?
No, absolutely. This guy is 40 gravity at the micron scale. Absolutely.
So the usual DGP thing, the large distances or the small numbers have to come from somewhere, right? And
right.
Usually they have to, assume some hierarchy of their Planck scales.
Absolutely.
And then they mumbled something about the huge number of degrees of freedom on the brain that do that, right? So when you go to high dimensional game, is it getting worse or is it getting better?
Yeah, it's getting worse because there's a hierarchy. So what we want is some hierarchy where M4 is much greater than M5 and much greater than M6.
So you have to populate, right? Not in the physical sense, but in the sense of the presence of the modes,
right?
Populations of.
No, absolutely. So in terms of there are all sorts of concerns as to whether this is embeddable in string theory. For me, I sort of put these issues aside. To me, it's like putting the cart in front of the horse. In the sense that. No matter how much you're disgusted by these brain on the brain and stuff like that, right, which you perfectly have a right to be disgusted, to me, it's the irrelevant question. Because first you should see, is there interesting phenomenology? And once there is, you might be able to simplify that. Once you understand what's that key here, you might be able to simplify the story tremendously. So far, I'm tolerating some pretty ad hoc constructions at the moment to see if the phenomenology works out to be nice.
But it's probably there is a limiting case to, I mean, if there are nodes, right, at some point at high energy might start exciting them. So there might be a limiting, like in large extra dimensions, there might be a limiting
absolutely
scale.
Yeah, yeah. If you put many fields lower the Planck scale, etc.
You might not realize inflation or something, you know.
Maybe you might get
in trouble with something else, right?
Yeah, I have an answer for not realizing inflation, but I'll leave that for another talk.
Just one more question.
I'm at a question before. Sorry, John.
So because you have higher dimensions, so you expect multiple scalar fields beyond just one.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
What are they like? Are they more or less like pi?
Very good. So I think we haven't worked out the pi Lagrangian explicitly. What I expect is that you can take some decoupling limit, and what you'll end up with is a 2 pi system. And they'll have these kinds of terms, each of them, but they'll have interactions in between them. That's what we expect.
One more comment. The standard state of the cosmological constant problem is that if you do a quantum field theory calculation of active phases, you get these huge numbers.
Exactly.
So if I do a quantum field theory calculation,
yeah, you get a huge number.
You still get this design.
That's right. But it's gradually, it's much more weak.
You still have a cosmological constant.
Absolutely. No, there's no problem. No, because the point is that it's very hard. The point is that there's a cosmological constant, but there's no cosmological constant problem.
You can demonstrate it in stability.
But hold on. So if I show you
one solution depends on the choice of parameters, right?
No.
Your solution, I
agree with you. This range of Planck scale, absolutely. No, don't start reading your paper. Come on.
That you're trying to convince me that you can actually calculate gradient in a theory where you don't know how to calculate M5 and M6.
Yes.
Apropos Maxime's point already.
Sure.
So you can tell me that you can calculate something on the brain and blah, blah, blah. And I believe that, at least in the language where you basically ignore gravity and imagine that you have, you know, look at short distance degrees of freedom, I mean, short wavelength degrees of freedom relative to curvature. That I'll buy the semi-classical argument in, you know, that is typically used, okay, counting also. That's
right.
Fine.
Right.
Then you will find, of course, that, you know, like in any such calculation, if you start putting in, you know, loops of standard model fields,
yes,
that answer will start changing by order one multiplicative factors.
Okay? Very good. Very good.
Then you will have to find that, in fact, your setup now needs to bend in by appropriate order one something else. And the only thing that can bend in is either the presence of a light degree of freedom that does that automatically,
right,
which you probably don't want because that will mess up, you know, whatever, gravitational limits and so on, or potentially restore instability, which is bad. And I believe that you can put that under control. I believe that you can, you know, take care of instability. But then the question is, the other possibility is that you readjust, you know, the other quote-unquote integration process. And that, of course, is where the core of the problem is.
Right. So I don't know if I'm going to answer what you raised, but one comment is...
I don't think so. That's okay.
Come on, then I won't answer anything.
Okay, that's great for lunch, and I'm coming back at 2:00.